remind you about, yeah, you'll remind them about the interaction again. It should all have more resonance now that you've just done these exercises.
Yeah, so the exercises that we did was meant to make you aware of the fact that current software is very complex, or rather complicated. Has many features, but as you said, you don't use them very much. And so you remember Wendy talking about power versus simplicity. So how can we create interfaces that are more powerful while still being easy to use, or where powerful stuff are easier to do? I will come back to stuff I talked in the first class, because I don't know, I have a sense that maybe it hasn't completely percolated into your brains. And we're going to really need it for the rest of the lecture, but also the rest of the course. So instrumental interactions. So you remember that I talked about the fact that our interaction with the physical world is often mediated with instruments, that we don't, we do some things directly with our hands, but we use tools a lot. And therefore, the idea behind instrumental interaction is to say, well, rather than pretend that we are doing direct manipulation in graphical user interfaces, and then create all these toolbars and dialog boxes and various things to indirectly interact with objects, why don't we make this interaction explicit and embrace it, but in the framework of tool mediation, rather than this kind of random pieces of interface that get thrown at us time and again. And so I took the example of the scroll bar as a tool that helps you navigate a document. And of course, you interact with the scroll bar interacts with the document, and you see the feedback both on the tool, because the thumb here moves, and of course on the document, because the document moves. So it's a richer type of interaction than just what direct manipulation proposes. And what I said is that we have identified three design principles that help us create interfaces that are instrumental. And the first one was reification. So I used the example of, so the scroll bar is the reification of the concept of navigating a document. And I also showed the example of the guidelines as the reification of the concept of alignment. So the idea here is that you think of when you're confronted with an abstract command, you try to figure out what tool you could create to enact this command into a physical-like object. The power that this gives you is that it makes the object, and therefore the command, explicit to the user. You can see it. And when you can see it, you want to be able to manipulate it. And so here what I showed is that with this guideline, not only it's more simple, if you've seen it once, you'll know how to use it, but it's also more powerful than the traditional alignment commands, because if with a traditional command, if I align three things, then I move one, then I want to realign the other, reselect and realign, or I want to put them into a group, but then there are things I cannot do with the individual elements of the group, so it gets complicated. And I like this distinction between something complex and something complicated. Does this mean something to you? So, there are things that are inherently complex. You know, if you're going to create, you know, the cockpit of an airplane, it, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you need to give control for to the pilot. So it's complex. Something complicated is when you made something that was simple complicated. So where you could have made it simpler, but somehow you didn't think hard enough, or you went for the easy way of slamming one new dialog box with a bunch of fields, and then you know, the user will then suffer. So we see a lot of complicated interfaces, but we also need to support complex interaction. So we have to be aware of this distinction. Yes?
Can Yes. And I think about, like, for example, rectangle, that you can write a rectangle and you can change it.
Yes.
But in the case of a line, you can explain it.
Okay, so were you here in the first class?
No.
Okay, that's why. But fortunately, here is the video that I showed. I'm not going to show all of it. So this is this concept of a guideline. So this is just to show the problem that, you know, people align and realign and distribute and fiddle with these dialog boxes. And so the idea is that the guidelines, the sticky lines, we call them, are going to give you persistence, control, etc. So the idea is that you align object, you create a line, then you attach objects to the line, they snap, and then you can move the line. Okay? So I've turned, and here then we can add properties, like now it's distributing objects, not just aligning them, distributing according to different reference points. Then I can have the line immediately grab all the objects when I create it. I can align on multiple lines simultaneously, and also to the sides of the object, not just the centers. And the idea is that here I can grab objects as I go. The idea is that once you have this object, you can do a bunch of things with it. Here the system is predicting alignments and creating the guidelines if you drop the object when the prediction is displayed. And so it's this idea that when you have this abstract thing, alignments, that then, you know, you get into all these additional setting or parameters gets complicated, we can make things a lot more simpler. Here it's about adding this little purple object here that we call a tweak to adjust the object so it's visually pleasing as opposed to just sticking with the bounding box and the center, geometrical center of the object. So it's clear now? Yes. So now, of course, you can say, well, you know, you pick these sticky lines, and that was an easy example. Well, it was an easy example, except nobody did it for the past 40 years. So, and there is a quote I found in the book, and it didn't say where it came from really, which says, "A good design is better than you think." Should write this down. A good design is better than you think. Because this is what happened with this and some other things. It's like you have an initial idea and say, well, that sounds cool. And then you realize that the more you sort of try to push it, the more it works and the more it inspires you to do new things. And that's where you get this notion of power out of simplicity, in a sense. Okay, so reification means we should think in terms of this objects that can that are explicit objects rather than something in the menu somewhere or some weird icon in some menu bar or toolbar somewhere, but something really that you can physically manipulate, like, you know, the hammer or the tools you use for everyday work. Now, the other thing that we found was very powerful was the notion of polymorphism. Because, you know, if you have a hammer, well, you can use a hammer to hammer a nail, of course, but you can use it to do other things. So a hammer is polymorphic in that sense. I use polymorphic here in the programming language meaning of the word, which you may not all know, but it means that that object can be applied to very different situations, different contexts, and it will do something. Maybe it won't do the thing I'm expecting, but maybe it will be a good surprise. So in computers, we have very little polymorphism because the programmers design things so that, you know, this, if I click this button to, say, take the tool in the toolbar, it's only going to work on that type of object. And then there's all these things where nothing happens because the programmer didn't design it, or the designer didn't design it, or the programmer didn't program it. So what we want instead is to embrace the ability to for these tools that we're creating to interact with as many different types of things as they can. So our favorite example for this is the color selector. And interestingly, you know, you go to, these are three different color selectors from Word, I think. The one I hate is this one. This is the one for highlighting. So if I want to change the color of the text in Word, if I want to change the background color, I get this one, or this one, and I can click to pick any color I want. But when I'm highlighting, you know, I'm stuck with those 12 colors, or whatever it is. Why is that? And then I shift to Photoshop, and then I get more funky color selectors here. None of these have anything remotely similar to what a painter palette would look like, where you mix colors together. There is this device that allows you to, or maybe it exists, we don't know. But you can get apps on your smartphone that pick a color from the real world. And so picking a color is something that you use in many different applications. So why is it that each one has to have its own or collection of color pickers that you cannot use in the next application? With the immediate consequence that it's very hard to reuse colors. Something that really drives us crazy, because we're a little bit obsessive about these things, is that if you copy and paste a color from Excel to PowerPoint, it's not the same color.
You can even type in the RGB values, and you still don't get the
same color. So, anyway, the point here is we want to think in terms of separating the what I call the tool from the type of content it interacts with, and make the tool work with minimum requirements from the stuff you're interacting with. So anything that can produce a color should be usable with anything that has a color as one of its attributes, right? So that's what polymorphism wants to promote. And finally, and I was clear in the exercise you had to do, we spend a lot more time reusing things than creating things from scratch because we are lazy. Right? So we want to support reuse.
We like to be efficient.
That too. And so we separate two types of reuse. The output reuse, where you reuse something that has been produced through things like copy-paste and duplicate. And so it's the objects that are reusing. It's distinct from input reuse, where you're reusing a series of commands that you apply to a particular object, but you want to apply them to a different object. So the most well-known one is redo. You use redo. Redo is my favorite command. In Excel in particular, it's very useful. But redo is only redoing the last one. And what happens to me all the time is I redo, 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 and then I have to do a tiny other change on the way, and then I redo again, and it's redoing the wrong command. Now, the other end of the spectrum, you have these tools like Photoshop and others that let you build macros. But then you have to do a lot more planning. So there's probably ways to do things in between to support reusing a series of commands and applying them to different contexts. Now, if we look at the sticky lines example, well, obviously we started with this idea of reification of alignment and distribution, in fact, in sticky lines. Those guidelines are polymorphic because they don't care what you align to them. I mean, anything that has a position and a size can be aligned to this object. So don't think of it necessarily as just something you would find in a drawing tool. I don't know, maybe I could use it to align windows on my display, or to align icons in my folders, or to align margins in text editing. So that's where the power of polymorphism shows up, is identify, well, for sticky line to work, all it needs to know is the position and size of the object. And the object can be anything. The other aspect of polymorphism is the very standard commands of moving things is used here with an additional effect that if you move an object onto the line, you attach it. Right? I didn't have to create a new command attach that object to that sticky line. I just interpret the action of moving on top of as the attachment. And so that means that with fewer commands, you get more power. And finally, because sticky lines are objects on the screen, they are or should be, I don't think the prototype implemented it, I don't remember, but I certainly should be able to copy a sticky line and paste it somewhere else. And I probably expect that this line will copy its objects and bring them with it.
I believe that works.
Yeah, I just can't remember. But you saw that in the process of making the sticky lines not only powerful, but also really matching the needs of graphic designers with this notion of tweak, we also reapplied the tweak. The tweak has become this object that you can select, copy and paste, or delete. So this is also a way to reuse things because the tweak is turned into an object. So to just wrap this up before we turn to the matter of today's class, these principles combine nicely with each other. They reinforce each other. Reification creates more objects, but polymorphism reduces the set of commands you need to do more things. Reification facilitates output reuse. If you have more objects on the screen, there's more ways to reuse them. And polymorphism facilitates input reuse, because if you reapply the same command to a different object, polymorphism will make it do something to that object, and therefore makes it more likely that it can be used. Yes?
So,
I would say your tool is polymorphic if you can apply the tool to objects of different types, yeah, and it does something. So,
sort of, it does the right thing. But then there's the question of what's the right thing, which is part B of this lecture.
Because then there's the thing about having a, so not the tool, but what the tool acts upon. So, like, for instance, I'm thinking in 3D computer graphics.
Yeah.
You know, you can represent the same thing as groups or mesh points or exist. And it's all the same object, but it has different, like,
interpretation. So, yeah. So that's a more, in a sense, literal interpretation of polymorphism. But I think it's a good point, because if one object can be seen under different representations, any given tool can pick the representation with which it can work. And makes, in a sense, this polymorphism of the object transparent.
Can you think of elements of reification, polymorphism, and reuse in the exercise we were just doing with the big So, you were, in essence, creating tools. You're using graphical objects as tools. So what were you reifying? Somebody give me an example of something that was reified in a graphical object that was then used as a tool. Some aspect of it that was reified into a tool. You had a nice example.
Rulers and spacers.
Right. So what are you reifying in the object that allows you to use it as a ruler?
Spacers.
So what's
spacing?
It's the width.
An object, yeah.
So an object has a width, so you've reified the width into being a spacer. Yeah? Right? So he's taking an aspect like alignment, you know, these things are aligned, okay, right? And now saying, okay, well, these things are this distance, I can take that distance and turn that into an object that I then use. So he's reifying that. Now, is it polymorphic? Do you use that width for more than one thing?
More than one square, but...
Well, really more than one square, but that's probably not quite what we mean. But remember I was talking about, you know, about figure and ground, like the, is the orange, is it orange squares on a dark colored background, or is it a bunch of lines on an orange background? One is figure and one is, and you get to choose which you think is in front and which is behind, right? So you could use your spacer to do spacing on the figure part or the ground part, for example. You know, so you could measure the size of, anyway.
Have you ever used, move the window in front of your drawing to verify that two things are aligned? So use the border of the window as a ruler?
With another example.
it's useful, it works.
When you press the mouse cursor on the loading bar to see if it moves.
Yeah.
To see if it's crushed or not.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the thing is, you are appropriating properties of an object in the interface for something that was really not designed for, but that suits your need. So it's like when you use, our favorite example. when you use, a pencil, you can use a pencil to draw a straight line because it happens to be straight. It's not a ruler, but it can work as a ruler.
Yeah, I can use this eraser. If this were a pen, I could use it not to erase, but to draw a straight line. And it's also for this reuse, and that's the last one. So you all use a lot of reuse, I assume, right? And we only have... We had one example when we first did each one by hand, but the rest of you created things and then you reused those subunits, and that turns out to be very common. So there's the idea that you've created, if you have a box of, so Martin, you created a 2x2, you make 4, and then you turn that into an 8, and then you turn it into a 9.
Yes, I'm using the copy tool.
That's right. And you're doing this build, right? You're building it. And then that becomes a unit, and then you can reuse that unit. So that kind of creation in time, and then you reuse those elements that you created. So you are all tool constructors. And you do this without thinking. It's just kind of all blended in. But as designers, you need to think about how you can facilitate that, and that's what these properties let you do. And I'll sit down.
Actually, I don't think we did we.
I don't think
watch
we did
this last time. No.
No.
Well,
this is
let's
really
watch
cool.
It.
Yeah.
So this is a project by Haijun Xia. Pronouncing his name well, from the University of Toronto, and Autodesk, as you can see. So it's created an interface for tablets, so touch-based interface to do vector-based drawing. And I think it's a very good example of verification because it's turned the attributes of objects into objects that you manipulate directly.
It might make sense to also mention that this is a nice case where he's been influenced by our research, and then he's done this, and he's working with Autodesk, and that's getting into the tools in Autodesk.
So here's showing how a classic... tablet application has just transferred this type of interface we talked about, that you select an object, tap there, you bring a dialog, you push buttons, then you say OK. So this is their interface. You select an object, and then this pops up and provides these panels of different properties. So this was a color that it was able to copy and paste. You can have a history of changes when you enlarge the panel. You can create a gradient or intermediate colors by linking two panels, and it does interpolation. And so it's using a very small set of design elements, these panels, to do a lot of things.
Can you just pause it there for a sec? Because it's going very fast.
I don't know how to pause with this thing. It's just
sorry. All right.
We're going to have to
Watching it again isn't so bad because it's just a lot going on. these properties that you pulled out when you're doing the F, right, these boxes, these are now being made explicit and then become something that you can manipulate explicitly. So when you wanted to use the width, that is an attribute that you can then explicitly use as a thing. So this part is kind of like other stuff, how people do that. We don't care about that. But the next bit is going to show how they're kind of extracting properties out of graphical objects, which is directly inspired by the instrument interaction.
So this is the, yeah. So he's doing a summary at the beginning to show the main features. So I think that the key idea here is that instead of having attributes in separate panels that you bring in and then close and know where they are, they're all attached to the objects that you manipulate. And they are refined into full-fledged objects. So I tap this, I have shape, fill, stroke, type fill. Here I have the color, you have a color and stroke width. So they are groups of attributes with sub-attributes. I can drag it out and back, which means it's reusable immediately because I can drag it out and attach it to another object. And then the ones that are less often used are on the right. You can extend the pull on the right to get the additional one. So sharing attributes is actually something you always want to do, and usually do it through styles. Here, what you do is you do a second tap with a second hand. You get a sort of linked copy of that, and you can attach it to that object down there. And now they are linked, so if I change this one, it will change the other one. It was very fast. it works. The linking
is the one where it's changing the colors, yeah.
So there's a bit of a different interaction to the linking. So if it changes the color of the light, it changes the color of the shadow. Alignment. What are they doing for alignment? Well, it does something a bit different. Okay. So the positions are attributes, and by copy and pasting them, you can give all these objects the same position. I think our guidelines are more powerful, but hey. So I don't want to show the whole video. I'll give you the link and you can look at it. But I think it's a very, first, it's a very good use of touch interaction and multiple multi-touch interaction. And
it's also a really nice use of somebody who's really absorbed the ideas of instrumental interaction and has been using it in a really systematic way, really taking advantage of it.
And so here they're grouping attributes just by stacking them, and then that's we did as a style that you can use as a whole. So what we find a lot is once you can group things together, you get a lot more power out of your interface. And that's the history where it remembers previous values for attributes, and you can access the history just by pinching out that particular tile and seeing the history. And blending is the thing we show at the beginning, where you tap two objects, you get this interpolator in between, which is its own object, and here is coloring the waves, and you see this very fluid interaction. One hand is moving left to right, and the other is tapping. Okay, I think I'm going to stop here.
Yeah. But it's a nice example, I've said it before, but it's a nice example of where research influences the people out there.
Okay, so today's lecture is about, okay, we talked a lot about the notion of tool or instrument that we interact with stuff. And so today we're talking about what is the stuff we interact with, and this is what we call substrates because it's a more fancy word than stuff.
Is that?
Yeah, that's my, the only reason. So, you know, if you take an app like paper, which is an iPad app, it has all these tools for drawing here. That's actually very pretty nice drawing app. There's another app here, I don't know if it still exists, iPhoto, where you can do, you know, basic photo retouching. And I think these are two examples of apps that you could say are pretty instrumental in a way. For example, here I like this fan of that show you the effect of different filters. So it's like, you know, you use the old variations and then you pick one, rather than again fiddling with different settings. And here you have drawing tools. This is a color mixer that looks a little bit like what you can do in a painter's palette. So these are cool. Now the thing is, what if I want to take that pen from that app and write on the picture? Why can you do that?
Import the picture to that.
Yeah. It can. But why, I mean, you know, you have to, it's a thought process that you have to then transfer the content from one app into the other. But then once it's in the other, well, what you have made is probably a copy. So you don't have access then to, so if I want to change the filter, then I have to bring it back here. So it's not very practical.
Is there like a format reason for that? For instance,
we'll get to that. The thing is, we should start with, okay, what do we want to do, and then the technology, you know, will follow, rather than say, well, yes, there are formats. But, you know, when I buy a pencil in a store, I don't have to buy a particular brand or type of paper to write on. It will write on any piece of paper, and you'll write on this table, on the wall. So these are constraints that we artificially impose in software. So yes, how to use the pen from the paper app to write on the photo in the iPhoto app. Now, the thing is, you've seen the movie Men in Black? Yes. Remember the neuralizer? Yes. I would like to neuralize you. And have you forget everything you know about using computers, because you grew up with computers. So this thing that, oh yeah, if it doesn't work in this app, I'm going to export and import and transfer it into that app and use it that way. You've lived in the world of apps. So your brain has been, you know, shaped to think in apps. And I want to change
warped.
That. Yes.
Coerced.
Yes, coerced. So I don't think it has to be the case. And I think it's interesting to think about, well, how could it be differently. So the thing is, you know, computers manipulate information that are presented as data, but this data, we give it meaning by interpreting it when it is part of what we call a substrate that provides the context for interpreting this data. All data on the computer ends up being zeros and ones, so that's not useful to you. And we talk about, you know, a photo file versus a music file versus a text document. And when we see a document, we sort of know what it is. In graphics, for example, you can do the exact same picture with Photoshop or Illustrator. But what's going to be easy in one is going to be very hard in the other, usually, right? So when I see a piece of text, I know it's text, so in a sense I expect it to be editable as text. Even if it turns out that I did that in Photoshop and it's just pixels at this point that don't remember they were letters at some point. So what we want to do is to say, well, data has exists in a substrate that gives it meaning, but data can also be interpreted in different ways, which gets to what you were saying, that, well, I can see something as a bunch of pixels or a bunch of shapes, or these shapes happen to be characters and I see text. So pixels, shapes, text. Well, depending on what I want to do with this content, I want to look at it and have different tools that work with it in its different types of representations. So most of the data we manipulate is very structured. Things of musical score, spreadsheet, the layout on the page, graph, etc. Data is highly structured. So the reason we're using the term substrate, because it's a word that is used in a number of areas. The substrate is, for example, in biology, it's the thing that provides the nourishing environment for an organism to develop itself. So I like this analogy, because we sort of want to...
We want
information to grow out of substrates. Substrates is also used in material science to describe this kind of types of materials that can be the base for other things or that can help to build things together. So these are physical substrates. When I talk about substrates, I talk about information substrates. So for me, this is a substrate. I don't look at this as a set of lines and dots. I look at this as music. Right? Now, at some point, maybe it will be interesting to look at it as pixels or as lines, but fundamentally, this is music. Now, the one on the right here, maybe you don't see structure there. But I'm sure the painter that created this palette had a structure in his head. And the reason he put the colors in certain positions so he could mix them in certain ways had meaning to it. So the meaning you put on the data is oftentimes in the head of the user and not explicitly represented in the system.
Can I do the dot example?
Do the dot example.
The dot
please.
Example. All right. So here's your challenge. Here, and I've got a set of dots. You are all playing smart computers, and I want you to give me the correct interpretation of those dots. What is that? Shoe? Yes.
You can connect the dots.
I could connect the dots and make a shoe. I could. Is there anything else I could do that would add meaning to these dots? I like the shoe. I haven't had the shoe before, so I like the shoe.
This one I have a I want to draw on the map.
Yes, it could be points on a map.
Stars?
Is it with colors? They can
be
stars.
Constellation?
Yeah.
A star? Yeah. Constellation. What about what's right there?
Music.
So if I do this, draw this right. Yeah, I did that a little bit weird, but well, let's make my dots a little more. Pretend I did this right. 1, 2, 3, 4, I need 5, right, and thing here, little flags, you know, and it matters, like, you know, that's not quite the same as that, and so I draw one here, right? So that could be music. So the point is that you've got data. Data is data. Ones and zeros, it's data. And there's a context that you lay on top of that to interpret it. So Martin, you were talking about, well, that could be this kind of file, that kind of file, or the other, we got nerves, we got this, we got that, busy curves, whatever. Yeah. But ultimately, it gets down to these little dots. And how you interpret it is where we start getting the system done with my little.
You didn't do that. If you do two axes, suddenly it looks like a graph.
Yes, it is also a graph.
Okay.
But, you know, we right.
Okay, so information substrates. Now, in the physical world, we are very creative about using substrates in various ways. So on the left you have, you know, a text that was typed with a typewriter, presumably, and then this is a Proust. Yeah, and he did a little bit of editing. On the right, it's a handwritten music score. And so if you just take these two things, you know, pens and paper, you already have a massive diversity of things you can do. You can even do things like this. Now try to do this with Word. I don't know. However, if we, you know, once you have a nail, everything looks like a hammer. Once you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Original saying. So it's interesting to look at existing software through this lens of, are there substrates already out there, or things we can interpret as substrates? In the same way as you can look at current interfaces as, do they have tools, do they have instruments? I'll show a few examples. And so yes, of course, we find a lot of examples of substrates. A spreadsheet is an interesting one, because you have one obvious substrate, which is this grid of cells, but then there is a hidden one that is all the dependencies between the formulas, which are here shown with all these arrows. And if you're building a substrate, if you're building a spreadsheet, you have in mind this set of dependencies somehow, because you know the formulas you've written, so you know which what is supposed to depend on which. Another example is that if you use a tool like Photoshop, you have to know and understand how layers work so you can use the tool efficiently. And there is a lot of, you read any tutorial on Photoshop online, it's all this cleverness about what you put in which layer, how you put filters in one layer, and how they superimpose. So this is a structure that is not explicitly visible in the final result, but that is critical for you to build that final result. And the thing is, when you have rich substrates, people appropriate them and use them in creative ways, of which this is not an example. This is the boring way of using Excel, right? To put numbers and draw stupid 3D pie charts. This is a more interesting way of using Excel. All of this was done in Excel. So yes, you can do the Ninja Turtles, the animated Ninja Turtles in Excel. This on the left is an Excel spreadsheet that then was laid out in kind of 3D, but it's data about, I don't remember if it's a traffic in Manhattan or electricity consumption or something. So all this data was put in something in the shape of the map of Manhattan. And then here is some kind of strategy game. I have no idea what the rules are, but that is made inside of Excel. There is a guy who does paintings that he sells that are done entirely in Excel. It's kind of a paint by numbers. It's kind of crazy. Okay, so how do we now define these information substrates? How can we create these things that will give more power to the tools we use? Okay, so last week you had an exercise about pencils, right? What can you do with a pencil? How many different uses of pencil did you find?
That's some that got to
20. 20? Okay. So these are the things you can do with a pencil. And so if you look at the list, I'm sure you started with, you can write with a pencil, and maybe then you can poke holes because it's spiky, and then you can draw lines because it's straight, maybe you can tie your hair, I can tie mine. All of these things are possible because you're using properties of that object, physical properties. It is straight, it is rigid, it's made of wood, so maybe, how many of you thought of burning pencil? Make fire? Yeah, good. So, so when you look at this, this is not a pencil, or this is not just a pencil. It's a bunch of atoms put together in molecules that make some specific material with specific properties that then is shaped into an object that has been designed to be used as a tool, and that is defined and redefined and evolved over time through use, and is also, you know, linked to various cultural aspects of the context in which it's been used. There's an entire book on the invention of the pen. Of the pencil, yeah, sorry. All the complications of putting the lead in the middle and the machines you need to do, so the tools you need to create, make pencils and all that. So, with computers, when you create a pencil tool in an app, all it does is to put some kind of ink and some kind of very specific support that this app supports. So there's this big difference between objects in the physical world, which can be used in different ways because of all these properties, and tools and objects in the digital world, which are designed, programmed to do one thing in one context. Now, this thing of the pen, if you look at it, is going from some very low-level stuff, the atoms of the thing, to objects, to the way these objects are used. So there's various levels of abstraction, in a sense. And when we think of digital substrates, I think it's the same. We think of an object, we can think of something we see on the screen at different levels of, I would say, representation. So if I have this graph, well, in the end, it all ends in pixels, because your screen can only display pixels, right? So everything has to be translated into pixels in the end. But of course, in that case, the pixels are not really the interesting structure. The interesting one is this rectangles that show the histogram. But in fact, this histogram is just a representation of a particular way of looking at data, which is a graph, an XY graph. And that data comes from a table where all of this is put into numbers. So when I look at this pixel at the top, in a sense, I see the table at the bottom, right? I interpret it as the table at the bottom. With each of these levels of representation come different types of tools. So if I'm thinking in pixels, I want to be able to paint. And maybe when I see this graph on the screen, maybe I want to be able to paint over it, to annotate it, to circle it, or something. If I think of it as shapes, I want to be able to maybe set the color of these shapes, maybe resize them. If I think in terms of, well, this is a graph representing data, so there are different types of graph. It can be a histogram, it can be a pie chart, it can be something else. And then if I think of it as the data table that is its sort of basic level, then I want to be able to enter data in that table. So I have one object on the screen, has multiple levels of representation. With each level come different tools that are adapted to this level. Now, of course, you can say, well, you're setting the color, that's fine, but if you start being able to take this shape and, say, move, reshape it, like you would do in an illustrator-like tool, well, what does it mean? I mean, are you just cheating with the data, or do you want to interact here in order to change the table view? So how are these layers connected together? I don't know exactly. And an application, a system will be more powerful if these are, in fact, properly linked so that, yes, the things I can make at one level will propagate down if needs be. So I can have more powerful ways of editing the content of the table, for example. So here's an example of a research project by Jennifer Jacobs, she was at MIT at the time, where I think she's taken this idea of making more powerful tools and creating a substrate for graphical, to do graphical drawings, whatever you call that, using ideas from, so it's called procedural drawing. It's probably better if I show the video. So the idea is that you can you can directly manipulate objects that are in fact collections of objects that automatically interpolate properties along the collection. So here she has this very simple shape that she created a collection from it, and then by distorting it you get visual effects that would be very cumbersome to do by hand. So you can access their attributes, you can manipulate collections of things, you can control, in fact, the attributes of the collections as well. So here you can pick a particular attribute, and then see what's going on. Then you can show that they are linked among the different parts of the flower here, so that when you change one, the others change. So it's kind of a spreadsheet embedded in in the drawing tool, if you wish. That's not really the part I wanted to show. I wanted to show when it goes to the multiplication. But so you see that what you're doing is that you're creating not specific colors, but relationships between colors. Which is sort of one level of abstraction. So here is when you start playing with collections of objects. I didn't revise the video, so I'm not sure what's coming up. And I cannot. This is really silly. I cannot scrub through the video with this thing.
Well, I think this idea that you're setting up, it's not that these things are just grouped and they're all treated together, but there's groups of relationships, and that you're creating fairly sophisticated relationships among these different elements.
So
its constraints are very important here,
right.
Thinking about establishing them, and it's established in a very physical way, so it's not writing code, it's drawing them and interacting with them. So now what she's doing is creating a range, and now she's...
So these are the two ends of the line, and then the thing gets recomputed. And here you can define how the distribution takes place. So it was linear, now it's radial, so you get a circular layout that you can control. And, I think I'm going to stop here maybe with this video, but I think it's a good example where, again, if you think of the properties of this substrate that holds this visual data, and you think in terms of not just the values of attributes, but the fact that you can specify relationships between those attributes, things get suddenly a lot more powerful. And all the power you have in Excel that you can use in crazy ways, you know, could be available in tools like this by allowing to express properties or constraints or relationships rather than absolute values. I like this example. So here she's taking a star. She's making a line of stars. Then she's going to say, well, I need more than...
Since that's too regular.
And then, of course, it's kind of boring to have all the stars be the same. So she's changing the color first, so we have a gradient of colors. We change the size as well. So if you resize one end, you get this gradient of sizes as well. And then you can change also the way the distribution is done. And there is a particular one that is random. And when you get random distribution, your stars are randomly distributed, and you get your star field in just a few clicks. Okay. Well, do you want to talk about paper substrates?
Well, I think I actually talked about that last.
Oh, you did?
Just briefly, yes. But I didn't really go into why there's substrates. So there's this notion that this gets closer to this kind of idea, which is that you're trying to, a musician who's doing composition is sort of looking at different relationships. So you have the notes relationship, and then you have these patches, which are basically mathematical functions in a system called open music. And then we have a physical piece of paper, which is actually translucent paper, and you can stack things on top of it and rearrange them and so on. So we have this mix of capturing the information in both physical and virtual form and being able to go back and forth easily between the digital and the virtual. And composers can actually compose in this system and treat it as not bad formulas, as notes, as basically sketches of ideas of how the music should sound, but in their own personal representation, which is sort of more like the painter with the palette of paints, where it's very different. And this is MuSync. I think I also talked. Did I tell? I showed you MuSync or not? I think I did. I mean, the idea here is that there's, again, a musical substrate, and we can create different things. But I think that's all right. Yeah, you can zip through that. And then I showed that as well.
You did?
Yeah.
You stole all my names.
No, I didn't. Just the music ones.
Okay, so
this is the one that is most important.
Yeah, so now we get to this notion that we've talked about tools and instruments, and now we've talked about substrate, and if it's blurry in your heads, it's normal. Interesting is, yes?
I think, I mean, we have this thing that we say, so a substrate contains data.
Yeah, but that's coming up.
Oh. It should be blurry because it's coming up.
All right. So, relationships between instruments and substrates. So the idea of an instrument is something that acts on something. And that's something we call a substrate. So instruments can manipulate substrates. And the idea is that an instrument, the way to think about it, the way I think about it, is the instrument sort of probes the substrate for specific properties. So if I'm an instrument that assigns color, well, I'm going to look if the substrate can receive a color or has a color attribute somewhere. If I am an alignment tool, I'm going to look at whether the substrate has a representation in which it has positions and sizes. Now, things get really messy when you think that instruments are themselves objects in the environment, so they are themselves substrates. And if you think of the sticky line that we talked about before, I mean, a sticky line is not the tool in the same sense as your pencil that you use, and when you're done, you put it aside, and that's it. The sticky line exists inside of the substrate itself to align the object and keep them aligned. So instruments can be also embedded inside the substrate, not necessarily be external objects. So we've been playing with these notions for quite a while now, and we've created, together with colleagues in the University of Aarhus in Denmark, this system called WebStrates. So what we wanted to do with WebStrates was to explore this notion in the context of the web, where the web is a nice environment because, you know, anything that is on the page, in the web page, is described internally by something called the DOM, the Document Object Model, which is a tree of the elements you see on the screen, and no matter how this DOM was created, you can bring it, you know, additional pieces of code, which is what all these extensions that you installed sometimes in your browser do. They inspect the DOM, and they don't know where it came from, but they can manipulate it from the outside. So the web sort of, in a sense, is already a potential substrate. And what we wanted to do with the web straights here was to, one, focus on the idea of sharing, make it so people could share content across multiple devices, and also blur the distinction between what is the content and what are the tools that we use to manipulate this content. So we're going to see a video here. So here you have the same document in this laptop, and here on the side where it's formatted in two columns, and they sync in real time. Here is drawing on the tablet. You see the drawing show up here, but show up in the real final layout of the paper as well, all in real time. And now here he has a very crude tool where he's writing SVG by hand, but you could imagine an Illustrator-like tool to turn this picture into something nicer. So here we have a tool for citing. So if I type Weiser and I click the cite tool, it adds the citation to Mark Weiser at the end. And to that, it uses a separate document, which is all the references, and it's showing them also in a formatted way. Now, this tool here is a piece of HTML that I can actually share with someone else, so I can open the other person's editor, paste the tool there, and that person now has the citing tool in her editor. So the same way I can copy-paste text, I can copy-paste the tool, essentially. That's the idea. Now, there's nothing particularly magic about this. I can go and edit the CSS live in the developer tools, for example. Here is doing something so the toolbar here can be hidden and shown. And so it's really because we are considering the DOM as a substrate that we're sharing. Now here's another application that's a slideshow. Here, so I can edit the slides the way I would do. My cite tool is working. I use the same cite tool here, just putting the references at the very end. I can fix the typo here. And when we get to the point where the slide is ready, we go to the conference. So to the conference, the presenter can have one version of the substrate, the web straights for sharing, one with his notes, and one for the audience. And one for the audience have a way to ask questions live during the talk. These questions are shared with the session chair. The session chair sees all the questions show up. He can pick the ones he thinks are relevant, put them in here, and this is in fact the last slide of the presentation that the presenter has shared. So when he gets to the last slide, you see the set of questions.
What's important to understand is that this is not an app. This is an environment where everything is shared. So how many of you use Microsoft Word? How many of you use LaTeX? How many of you use Pages? Have you ever been in a situation where you've had to collaborate on a document where somebody wanted to use Pages and you wanted to use Word and somebody else wanted to use LaTeX? Anybody? Well, we have, because this happens to us all the time. It will happen to you when you move into, you'll either move into a company where they make you use this because they want to have everybody in the same system. And they do that to our assistants at INREA. They make them all upgrade.
You work in a company, that's what
you're using their software, you're using their software, and you're doing it their way. Or you're like in a research environment where everybody does it their own way, and then you have to negotiate. In this environment, for this paper, I used a sort of Word-like interface. You used more LaTeX-like, and Clemens was hacking the code in the basics. And we're all always at the same time on the same document.
So this is not Google Docs. You all use Google Docs, I suppose.
Yeah, sure,
right? So the thing is, to use Google Docs, you have to use Google Docs. You don't have an option. You don't, you know, the interface is what Google decided it was, and you're stuck with that. The big difference here is that we say, well, there is this internal structure representing documents in web browsers that is standardized. It's called the DOM. So we're going to work at the DOM level. So anything that is in the DOM is shared. We have a server that synchronizes the various views. If you take my group or class, I'll tell you how it works. And we consider that the DOM is really the sort of shared ground truth by all the users. Now, with the DOM, we can play two tricks. One is through CSS, we can style things differently, so make things look quite different according to the device you're using, for example, or the choice of whether you want something, you know, with a nice two-column WYSIWYG or something more like just the text, etc. And we play another trick, which we call transclusion, which is that through something called iframes in the DOM, you can have a page embed another page. So in fact, my editor is a document, and it transcludes, it includes the text itself, which is another document. That your editor is a different document, but it transcludes the same text that we're editing. So that's why we can share the text we're editing, but each have our own interface to edit it. And then since that editor is a document like any other web document, the tools that we use, they're a piece of HTML, a piece of JavaScript, so if they're well designed in terms of being, you know, well interfaced to the environment, we can take one of these and plug it into another document, and they work, and we saw that moving it from one editor to the next, and also in the slideshow. So it's the kind of thing that we can do when we push this idea of let's consider one form of representation, make that shareable, and make it support both content and tools to create interfaces.
So we have text editing, making slides, doing graphics, everything, with your favorite editor versus your favorite editor versus your favorite editor for each of those things. And it's all the same. And if you come up with a clever new tool, you can share it here, and so on. So we've got this really deep sharing and basically wiping out the notion of there being, you know, this application does this and that application does that. And what that does, if you wanted to take a marketing point of view, you would have more like the tool store than the app store. You wouldn't buy applications. You'd start with a basic foundation that we get from different web browsers. It would be like having different web browsers that you could choose. And then you can buy and sell tools and do complicated, you know, fancy tools and simple tools. It also means that we have an example in the paper where we have like somebody who's a professional graphic designer wants to be able to do great stuff, but then has a four-year-old kid and they want to, you know, do coloring with the kid. That should not be jumping from one application to another. It should just be using different tools that are appropriate to the person and to the task at hand. You don't have video straights, do you?
No.
Yeah, we should probably show video straights as a because we have the latest one that hasn't actually been, it's just come out this year, that is doing all of this with not just text and graphics, but also with video. So that's hot off the presses. Okay.
So to summarize, what's a substrate? So a substrate holds content. It can be numbers, text, images, video, sound, you name it. But it's also important that the substrates can contain other substrates. So what we saw in the video is there's even though it's all the DOM, inside this unified structure, there are things that you are going to recognize as being text with properties specific to laying out text, and other parts that are maybe graphics that maybe are using SVG, which is a dialect for representing graphics. And the idea is that you can put in tools that manipulate this or that type of content. So a substrate has content. The second is a substrate has structure. It's organized. So it can be a sequence of things. It can be a tree. In the DOM, it's simply a tree. It can be more complex things. but it has rules in the sense that specifies the structure. And then within the structure, you want to be able to create and to maintain relationships, constraints, and rules. Use this interchangeably. In a sense, it's anything that you put in the substrate should be specified either as a value or, like in a spreadsheet, as a formula that is calculated from other values. So that's how you can create this inner constraints in the substrate and make it a lot more powerful. Okay? I think
it's time for a break.
Done. I think it's time for a break.
Yeah. Okay. So what time is it now?
3:30.
3:30, so 3:45 back here. As a reminder, you can go out these doors if you want to get to there. They are open, or at least they should be open, and then you can get back in again that way. So you don't have to go that way around. It seems to find the video screens. No? No, I guess.